And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the Free Radio studios of Santa Cruz for another week. We're going to bring you some news and announcements and stuff like that, but it'd be a good idea if you had a pencil and paper handy, because you might want to write something down. Some place to go, some web page, some idea that maybe hit you. Who knows? Your first update can be thought-provoking. Let's start off with announcements. Coming up next weekend, September 19th through the 21st, the Fall Campout in the Book Cliffs, a weekend of stories and connecting with the land. And Utah Tar Sands Resistance sent this to us via the Earth First Newswire. On the weekend of September 19th to the 21st, Utah Tar Sands Resistance and Friends will be hosting a fall campout in the Book Cliffs. It will be time for folks from the Uinta Basin, Moab, Duran Junction, and other surrounding areas to meet, visit the land, and share stories about regional struggles. There will be fireside chats featuring stories about important regional movements such as the nuclear test site protests and past efforts to halt tar sands mining in the Colorado Plateau. We'll also have bird watching, animal tracking, plant identification, and drone walks. They'll get to know the land better. And we'll talk about the indigenous history of the Tavaputs Plateau. We're holding this gathering because we realize we have much to learn from other regional movements. We also realize that sharing stories with one another empowers all of us to take bolder action for a just and livable future. Please join us in strengthening the regional network of people committed to keeping this little planet of ours alive through the dark deep work of conversation, sharing our experiences, our fears, and yes, our joys as we talk about what resistance means to us and what gives us hope for the region we love so much. They'll be announcing the campsite a little closer to the date. Hopefully I'll have it next week, but it will be in the PR Springs area. To those living on the plateau this summer, have discovered a variety of beautiful sites to camp, so we're excited to share that all with you. We'll post signs prior to the event to make sure everyone can easily find it. Breakfast and dinner will be provided. Bring your own lunch and snacks and whatever. If you have any questions, email tarsandsresist@riseup.net. That's tarsandsresist@riseup.net. Once again, September 19th through the 21st, the fall campout in Utah's Book Cliffs. And Lazad protesters have buried themselves in a road to stop machinery, in this story from Revolution News, as found on the Earth First Newswire. While violence has escalated, as we reported last week, resistance intensifies at Testet against the proposed construction of the Sivens Dam, all this occurring in France. Five forest and wetland defenders have been buried in the roadway with only their heads and shoulders above ground in an effort to halt the destruction of a wetland of 13 hectares, about 25 acres or so, a jewel of biodiversity where 94 protected species live. Despite the stubbornness of the authorities to continue clearing this morning, formidable ecological opposition extends through the region and beyond. On Sunday, September 7th, nearly 1,000 people gathered at the scene peacefully to express their opposition to this archaic and environmentally damaging project. Opponents of the project are motivated by the disappearance of wetlands and denounce the irrigated agricultural model. They denounce an outdated vision of agriculture. According to them, a wetland is a result of a long natural process, and they denounce the overall cost of the dam, whose construction is estimated by the General Council at 8.4 million euros. That's about $10 million, an annual operating cost estimated by opponents of more than 300,000 euros. On September 2nd, 10 Zetas were injured by the French police, who resumed their tactics against the occupation of Sivens Forest and Wetlands in order to clear the way for developers to build a dam considered useless, even more since it implies the destruction and deforestation of 13 hectares. Occupiers naming themselves ZAD, Zona Defendre, meaning area to be defended, have been fighting the state and capitalists for a year now to save the forest. Previous occupations have been brutally repressed by police. Protests have been violently attacked. Activists even started hunger strikes in vain to force local authorities to hold public debate. And four Ashanika tribe members have been killed by loggers in Peru, in this story from Manga Bay, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Four Ashanika were killed last week by illegal loggers in the Peruvian Amazon, reports El Comercio. One of those killed was Edwin Chota, leader of the Alto Tamaya Soweto indigenous community, who won fame for fighting illegal loggers. As such, Chota was the top target for assassination, according to a conservationist familiar with the situation. Details about the other victims weren't immediately available. The murders occurred on September 1st, but the remoteness of the area delayed the news, which was first reported by writer Sebastian Quinticotti, president of the CONAMAC, or La Asociación de Comunidades Nativas Ashinicas de Masiasi y Cayería. What a name. Our people have always defended our resources and have faced illegal loggers who see our reserves as a place to exploit, El Comercio quoted Sebastian as saying. Conflicts between loggers and indigenous communities are common in Peru. Loggers often operate illegally within indigenous territories and launder the wood through legal concessions. A report published in 2012 by the Environmental Investigative Agency found forestry fraud widespread in Peru, with large volumes of contraband timber making it to the United States market as legally sourced timber. With a population estimated at 25 to 45,000, the Ashaninka are the largest tribe of the Peruvian Amazon. Small groups of Ashaninka also live in Acre, Brazil. And a Yellowstone Wolf Patrol will begin wolf hunt monitoring in Montana in this story by Laura Lindquist of the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, as found in the Earth First Newswire. Wolf defenders led by a somewhat famous activist from out of state have chosen to focus their efforts on the greater Yellowstone area this fall, but some local wolf advocates don't want them here. A new group called the Yellowstone Wolf Patrol plans to arrive in the Gardner area by September 15th, the opening day of the rifle wolf season, to document the wolf hunt north of Yellowstone National Park and to educate visitors about wolves, said the group's leader, Rodney Coronado. Taking a cue from the Buffalo Field campaign, a group of about 9 people from several states intend to patrol the park boundary to monitor and document hunting activity and to serve as a deterrent against hunters pursuing wolves into the park, Coronado said. Last year, Coronado and the group organized the opposition to the first wolf hunt in his home state of Michigan. We're hoping to start a movement of monitoring projects that people will want to do in several states. We're starting here in Montana because it's one of the earliest seasons, but we plan to be in Wisconsin for the hound hunt there, Coronado said. We're focusing on the Yellowstone area because we think it's feasible for them to make the changes to protect wolves. Coronado said the group members oppose the decision of the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commission to allow limited wolf hunting in Hunting District 316 north of the park. Adjoining the eastern half of the northern park boundary, Wolf District 316 now has a quota of 3 wolves because in May, the commission reduced last season's quota by 1. Wolf District 313 around Gardner also has a quota of 3 wolves. The 2013 legislature made quarters mandatory for hunting districts around Montana's national parks to prevent the commission from closing the districts without a hunt, effectively creating a buffer area. But the Yellowstone Wolf Patrol wants that buffer to protect the park wolves that have been the subject of years of scientific research. Coronado said wolf researchers oppose indiscriminate recreational hunting because it breaks up family units so pups don't learn from their parents what to avoid and what it doesn't target, and because it doesn't target problem wolves. He's also concerned about the recent Fish, Wildlife, and Parks rule allowing landowner kills. We are not opposed to wolves. He is also concerned about the recent... We're not opposed to hunting. I'm not opposed to people filling their freezers with elk or venison. But killing apex predators that aren't eaten and aren't directly responsible for livestock predation, I just don't think that's right, Coronado said. Wolves of the Rockies spokeswoman Kim Bean agrees with Coronado in principle, but takes the issue of with his methods after she and other wolf advocates lobbied to lower the quota in Hunting District 316. We busted our asses to get these things happening to try and get a relationship with the state to do things in a way that's not going to get a lot of pushback. That's the problem when you've got people coming in and pushing an agenda without understanding the repercussions of that agenda, Bean said. If we have groups like this coming in and making waves, it makes it harder on those of us who are trying to do it in a better way. Coronado is a well-known animal rights activist who used to make direct action to fight animal cruelty. He was jailed in 1995 after trying to destroy a Michigan State University laboratory that did animal testing, and again in 2005 after dismantling a lion trap in Arizona. And after 6 years in prison, he has had a change of heart. The Yellowstone Wolf Patrol will go into the Absaroka Wilderness and patrol the park boundary where wolves have been shot before, Coronado said. They'll look for elk herds and watch for any wolves that follow. He said the patrol probably wouldn't be wearing hunter's orange, trusting that the kind of hunters who went into the backcountry don't shoot without confirming their target. If we're in the situation where we see that a wolf might be killed, at the very least, we want to document that and share it with the world, Coronado said. We're very aware of the potential for conflict, and we want to avoid that. We'll be in an observer role on public land, not with an intention of interfering. We want to do something that's sustainable. Being worried that the patrol could end up betraying the wolves' whereabouts to hunters, stay away from the wolves, leave them alone, Bean said. And here in California, a mountain lion has been slain after an attack. This story by Terry Collins and Andrew Dalton of the Associated Press. Wildlife officials said today that it could take up to 2 days of testing to determine if they shot and killed the same mountain lion that attacked and injured a six-year-old boy on a Northern California hiking trail. Rabies testing could be finished sometime Thursday, while DNA results would be available as early as Friday, said Lieutenant Patrick Foy of the California Fish and Wildlife. Officials said DNA from saliva and bite marks on the big cat that the big cat left on the boy in his clothing, and they will also check under its claws. After 4 days of scouring rugged terrain, search crews and dogs found and chased the mountain lion up a 70-foot tree Wednesday before fatally shooting it on a trail near the Silicon Valley city of Cupertino, California. Officials believe it has the right animal based on its description, its aggression towards the crew, and close proximity to the spot of Sunday's attack. We're pretty confident, otherwise we wouldn't have killed it, Foy said. It's highly likely, but we can't be 100% certain until we get the DNA. Wildlife officials defended the decision to kill the 65-pound juvenile mountain lion instead of trying to bring it in alive because it was deemed a threat to public safety. One wildlife expert on Thursday said it was likely a tough call to kill the animal instead of tranquilizing it. We don't know if this animal had some sort of disease issues that affected its behavior, said Janet Alexander, an operations director for the nonprofit Wildlife Center of Silicon Valley in San Jose. In most situations, we would certainly prefer that non-lethal methods be used to capture an animal. We hope there won't be any more incidents like this. For example, she said a mountain lion was tranquilized by wildlife officials after it scampered through the nearby city of Mountain View last May. It was later released into the Santa Cruz Mountains. The male mountain lion killed this week was difficult to tranquilize and capture while up in a tree and likely would have died in the fall, Foy said. The conditions made it really not a viable option, he added. We figured we'd better get it in hand. Officials said the injured boy was released from the hospital on Monday, the day after suffering bite wounds and scratches on his head and neck while hiking with his family and others. The name of the boy has not been released. The boy's father told investigators his son was about 10 feet ahead of a group when the mountain lion jumped out of nowhere and mauled him. Also here near Santa Cruz, the San Vicente Redwoods are one of the biggest unprotected forests around, in this story by Curtis Alexander of the San Francisco Chronicle. For more than a century, the coastal town of Davenport, California, just up Highway 1 from Santa Cruz, stood in the shadow of a giant cement plant. Many of the town's 400 or so residents worked in the factory, lived in the homes beneath its smokestacks, and gazed up at thousands of acres of wooded hillsides that plant operators mined or logged. With the closing of the plant 4 years ago, amid a declining economy and environmental concerns, has ushered in a new chapter for the community, and conservation groups marked a major milestone last week in a bid to preserve the picturesque land and open it to the public. The vast acreage, roughly 6 miles long and 2 miles deep, holds one of the largest unprotected swaths of redwood forest in the region. It's home to mountain lions, peregrine falcons, and coho salmon. Environmentalists and local leaders say it's ripe for a trail system linking Big Basin Redwood State Park and the federally run Coast Dairies Bluffs. The town of Davenport was there because of the cement plant. Now we really have the opportunity to pivot and turn a major polluter into a real positive for the community, said Santa Cruz County Supervisor Neil Coonerty, who represents the rugged coastline north of Santa Cruz. The preservation effort in Davenport is one of the biggest and priciest the region has seen. In 2011, the Peninsula Open Space Trust of Palo Alto partnered with the Sempervirens Fund of Los Altos to buy 8,500 acres from the plant owner Cemex for $30 million. But because neither group is in a financial position to hold the property and manage it, and California's state park system has been shy about funding new acquisitions, the groups plan to sell the land to a private party. To make sure the future owner doesn't lay waste to the land, the groups are working with the Save the Redwoods League of San Francisco to draw up a conservation easement that would permanently bar development. Last week, the California Wildlife Conservation Board approved $10 million in public funding to move that easement forward. This is one of the most substantial redwood forested properties in the Santa Cruz Mountains, said Sam Hodder, president of the Save the Redwoods League. The easement will make sure these lands stay an intact forest, undivided and undeveloped. Now the plan to protect the Cemex land from development seems to be sitting well with many residents. Roger Knapp, a real estate agent who lives in Davenport with his wife and 9-year-old son, said he looks forward to bird watching and hiking on the property, which he can see from his front door. It's been privately held and patrolled for a long time. Access has been real limited, he said. I see this as a real positive. Knapp's only concern, which is shared by others in the community, is that the redwoods will bring an overwhelming number of visitors to town. We're all just hoping that Davenport can retain its unique charm, he said. You can figure the whole greater Silicon Valley coming to your street, parking and walking around. The Land Trust of Santa Cruz County is leading the effort for public access, though it hasn't been determined exactly where visitors might enter the former Cemex property, now called San Vicente Redwoods. And the Conservation Consortium is still figuring out how crowds will be managed and policed within the sprawling forest. Catherine Elliott, project manager with Save the Redwoods League, said she also expects the site to offer an economic boost to Davenport through tourism. But the most important feature of the project, supporters say, is simply the land itself. It's beautiful hiking in this redwood, said longtime Davenport resident Noel Bach. How wonderful to have this land opened to the community. And a warmer climate means greener mountains, but less water for Californians. Freshwater runoff from the Sierra Nevada may decrease by as much as one quarter by the year 2100 due to climate warming on the high slopes, according to scientists at UC Irvine and UC Merced. Accelerated plant growth at higher elevations caused by increasing temperatures would trigger more water absorption and evaporation, accounting for the projected runoff declines, the researchers add. The diminished river flow will only add to the burden of providing resources to the thirsty farms and homes that rely on it. The state currently is experiencing a severe drought, and some reservoirs and groundwater levels are at all-time lows. Scientists have recognized for a while that something like this was possible, but no one had been able to quantify whether it could be a big effect, said UC Irvine professor of Earth System Science Michael L. Gooden of the decreased runoff. It's clear that this could be a big effect of climate warming and that water managers need to recognize and plan for the possibility of increased water losses from forest evaporation. According to researchers, runoff from mountain ranges is vulnerable to temperature hikes that lengthen the growing seasons and result in more vegetation growth at high elevations. Snow-dominated mountain forests that are currently dormant in winter with cold temperatures have lower vegetative density and less evapotranspiration than downslope forests in the snow-rain transition zone, which have year-round growing seasons. Evapotranspiration is the combination of water evaporation from land and the loss of water through plant leaf transpiration. Goulden and UC Merced's Roger C. Bales investigated the potential influence of a warming climate on evapotranspiration in the Kings River Basin in California's Sierra Nevada and found resulting changes in the amount of freshwater mountain runoff available to serve surrounding communities. They gauged water vapor emission rates and combined those measurements with remote sensing imagery to determine relationships among elevation, climate, and evapotranspiration. According to the data, freshwater mountain runoff is highly sensitive to expanded vegetation growth. The authors found that greater vegetation density at higher elevations in the Kings Basin, with a 4.1 degree Celsius warming projected by climate models for 2100, could boost basin evapotranspiration by as much as 28%, with a corresponding 26% decrease in river flow. Further, the relationships among evapotranspiration, temperature, and vegetation density were similar across a broader range of the Sierra Nevada, suggesting that the impact of climate change on evapotranspiration and freshwater availability could be widespread. Most people have heard about the giant forests around Yosemite and Sequoia National Parks, but those areas have not been a focus of this type of research. Understanding of Sierran hydrology has improved recently with the National Science Foundation's Critical Zone Observatory, and data collected there allowed us to look at the problem from several perspectives, Goulden said. All of our analyses pointed in the same direction. An upslope expansion of forest with warming could cause a large increase in evaporative water loss and lead to reduced water availability. And down in Florida, two endangered Florida panther cubs have died after being hit by cars. In this story by Letitia Stein, with editing by Colleen Jenkins and Bill Trott of World Environment News Thomson Reuters. Two rare Florida panther cubs were struck and killed by cars last weekend, authorities said, bringing the total road deaths for the endangered species to 16 for this year. The four-month-old panther cubs appeared to have been hit in separate incidents while crossing a rural road in Collier County in the southwestern part of the state, according to the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Officials said they found indication that the kitten's mother was with them at the time and that she appeared to be unharmed. Our concern is that she may come back looking for her kitten, said Daryl Land, the agency's Florida Panther team leader. The number of Florida panthers has more than tripled in recent decades to between 100 and 180, according to government estimates, but the species remains a long way from being downgraded from the endangered species list. Land said that motorists who struck the panther kittens did not call to seek help after the collisions, which occurred late Saturday night or early Sunday morning. The female kitten was the first to be discovered. The cub's sibling found on the other side of the road had been hit multiple times. Wildlife officials could not determine the second kitten's gender. And the American Bird Conservancy objecting to Army plans to kill 16,000 birds. American Bird Conservancy has raised multiple objections to assertions by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in their proposal to kill 16,000 cormorants on East Sand Island in the Columbia River estuary as part of a plan to reduce predation of juvenile salmonids, including salmon smolt, by the birds. The Army Corps plans to kill the double-crested cormorants over a period of 4 years was outlined in a draft environmental impact statement for their double-crested cormorant management plan to reduce predation of juvenile salmonids in the Columbia River estuary. The conclusions reached in the DEIS prompted the American Bird Conservancy to send a comment letter to Sandra Ruckward at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Portland District Office. Quoting, "We have deep concerns about the draft environmental impact statement and the preferred alternative," unquote, said Dr. George Wallace, ABC Vice President for Oceans and Birds. Returning to the quote, "The determination that the breeding population on ESI must be reduced to approximately 5,600 breeding pairs is not based on any rigorous or peer-reviewed analysis," unquote. The lethal approach being recommended by the Corps in reducing the number of cormorants is offered, quote, "without adequate justification or explanation of why the same result cannot be achieved through non-lethal methods," unquote. Furthermore, the recommended alternative would reduce the entire western double-crested cormorant population by about 25%, constituting a depredation control order going beyond local ramifications to encompass the entire western cormorant population. And critical habitat has been proposed to conserve western yellow-billed cuckoos. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has proposed to designate critical habitat for the western population of the yellow-billed cuckoo, but the American Bird Conservancy is concerned that the draft rule does not provide necessary habitat protection for the imperiled bird species, whose numbers have plummeted in recent decades. The draft rule proposes 546,335 acres of critical habitat in Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming. However, Fish and Wildlife Service is considering the exclusion of 193,691 acres, and the draft rule does not designate smaller patches of currently occupied habitat. In the United States, only 350 to 495 pairs of yellow-billed cuckoos exist, with a similar number found in Mexico. The birds are isolated in small patches of increasingly degraded riparian forest habitat. The species has been extirpated, or nearly so, from most of its historical range across portions of 12 western states, as well as British Columbia. In California, the population is estimated to be less than 1% of its probable historic size. Very small populations of less than 10 pairs exist in Nevada, Wyoming, Colorado, and Texas. And in Idaho and Utah, only an estimated 10 to 20 pairs remain. In its December 2, 2013 letter to Fish and Wildlife Service, the American Bird Conservancy raised concerns that the agency's proposed threatened listing wasn't enough and should be changed to endangered status due to very low population numbers and the lack of adequate regulations to halt habitat loss and degradation. Quoting again, the Cuckoo's draft listing rule found there is ongoing degradation and habitat loss and concludes that these impacts are anticipated to continue for decades to come, unquote, said Steve Holmer, senior policy advisor for the American Bird Conservancy. Quoting again, these factors point to the need for a more robust critical habitat designation. And in our final story tonight, in face of legal challenges, Idaho has suspended wolf killing. Big news out of Idaho, the state's Department of Fish and Game facing a legal challenge by conservation groups, including the Center for Biological Diversity, has called off plans to kill more wolves this winter in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. A hunter-trapper hired by the department killed 9 wolves in the Frank Church last winter, and state officials in February announced plans to kill 60% of the wolves in the Middle Fork section of the wilderness in coming years. Center for Biological Diversity and its allies filed a lawsuit against the wolf-killing plan, and the first hearing was scheduled. Idaho officials now say they're suspending the plan until at least November 1st, 2015. We're happy to see Idaho's wolf get a much-needed reprieve from the state's ill-conceived killing plan, at least for a year. That's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast of this show, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And if you're in Moscow, Idaho, tune in to Free Radio Moscow, KRFP Idaho, 90.3 FM on Monday nights at 9:30. You can also go to radio4all.net, that's radio the number 4all.net, to listen to a podcast or download this or prior Earth First Updates. And we'd like to add that radio4all.net is in dire need of funding. They are a resource for small, independent, and radical radio stations and radio producers by keeping archives of my shows and a whole lot of other shows from a whole lot of other really great independent programmers. So go to radioforall.net and click in the upper part of their webpage and please send a donation to radioforall.net. That way they can stay in business and keep recording or storing recordings of my show and making them available to other radio stations. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening, and please tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.